This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Looking for the best kind of trade, the best kind of debt, and the best solutions to climate change. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, November 10th. Veterans Day is observed today. Thanks for joining us. Let's begin, as we like to do on Fridays, with our weekly wrap, a look back at the big business stories, and there were many. With me, Lee Gallagher from Fortune and Rachel Abrams from the New York Times. Hello there.
Hey there.
I'm Molly.
Hi. All right. So I feel like we should start with taxes. There are still big questions about how we're going to pay for these various proposals. And then, of course, they have to be reconciled. Rachel, if you had to guess at a few things that might stay and might go, what would you predict?
I'll pull out my crystal ball, and I would say that almost certainly corporate tax rates are going to be cut because both the Senate bill and the House bill both are pushing for that. But there are some popular deductions that are probably going to be up for debate, especially because in the Senate, it doesn't look like Republicans have enough votes to get their bill passed through reconciliation. They need 60, and there have been enough senators expressing doubts about the current version that it's likely there will have to be some concessions made. And the Senate bill, for instance, eliminates the deduction for property taxes, and that's a very popular deduction that is going to hurt a lot of middle class folks. And of course, this tax bill is being presented as something that's really going to benefit the middle class. But if you run both versions through the machinery that can calculate this stuff, it looks like both the middle class could be affected and the tax rates could go up under both versions. So there's a lot of popular deductions that people are sort of expecting to see change a little bit.
Yeah, Lee, there's still this effort to, sell this as a middle class tax cut. Gary Cohn in an interview said as much again yesterday. Do you think that people are buying that?
I don't think anyone's buying that. And that is, the biggest similarity between the two. I think that's true for both of them. I mean, the biggest differences between the two bills are, as Rachel said, the property tax, but also the Senate version eliminates the state and local tax deductions, which is a big deal, especially for high tax states like New York and California and New Jersey. So there's going to be a lot of tinkering. The Republicans in the Senate, they can only lose two votes if they want to pass it without any Democratic support. And probably the final bill will look more closely like the one in the Senate. But they also delayed the corporate tax cut until 2019, which, of course, saves a lot of money. But that's going to have a big impact on businesses. And also, I mean, the markets reacted to that because that could incentivize people to companies to delay any expansion plans they had for the next year. So all of this still needs to be sorted out in a big way. But a lot is on the line because health care didn't pass. And especially after the elections we saw this week, Republicans have to show that they can get this done in some way.
All right, let's turn to trade briefly. President Trump's speech, which we're going to talk a little more about later in the show, was described as a vision of a new world order for trade. How does, Rachel, we were talking a little about this, how does China fit in with the speech that the president gave today in Vietnam?
Well, the president today said basically has made some comments that he's made before, which is that America has really lost out, that other countries have benefited at the expense of the United States. And obviously, he has pulled away from some really powerful international agreements that include like the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, and the Paris Climate Accord, of course. And I think that there are some countries that want to move ahead on TPP, for example, without the United States. And some observers say that this is all leaving the absence of the United States is leaving a bit of a vacuum that where China could step in and really be a leader in some of these big agreements. So I think the big question is, how does China see this opportunity, and will they sort of step in some of these big powerful ways?
Mm-hmm. Lee, do you think is it worth it to cede the national stage, as some have portrayed it, if we get better trade deals out of it?
I don't know
the
about that.
Stage,
I mean,
rather.
I think right. I don't know. I think that a big thing that's also coming into play here is North Korea, and which isn't about trade, but it's about having any kind of we need China. China being a key player in our negotiations with North Korea to the degree there are any. And I think that's what a lot of the flattery that you saw. I mean, 2 days ago it was, have you ever seen anything more beautiful than this military parade? We have great chemistry. I mean, it's sort of a little bit all over the place. But I think that is underlying all these discussions.
Lee Gallagher from Fortune and Rachel Abrams from The New York Times. Thanks, rappers.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, more drops on tax jitters. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's talk about trade a little bit more here. President Trump and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping both spoke at an Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in Vietnam today. The Chinese president, as you heard, spoke about economic openness and international cooperation. Mr. Trump pledged to put America first and said the U.S. should pursue bilateral trade agreements instead of multilateral ones, one at a time instead of lots at a time. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains.
When you have a whole bunch of countries trying to draft a trade agreement, it's inevitably slow and messy. Bilateral deals can be simpler. Derek Scissors is an Asia economist at the American Enterprise Institute.
I think what the president would like would be to deal with rich countries that look something like the U.S. so that we agree on a lot of issues.
For example, instead of working with the 11 other countries in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a deal Trump pulled out of after taking office, maybe we just focus on a prize target like Japan. Problem is, Japan still wants the TPP.
There are a very limited number of countries that will want to work with us under those conditions.
Peter Petrie is a professor of international finance at Brandeis University. He says multilateral deals, complex as they are, can have broader appeal.
For example, the United States may offer benefits to Vietnam, which may in turn offer benefits to Japan. And then Japan would offer benefits to the United States, and everybody would win.
Dan Eikenson with the Cato Institute says the next most likely candidate for a one-on-one deal with the U.S. isn't in Asia at all. It's the U.K.
Because both the U.K. and the U.S. are sort of the outlaws in the international system right now. All the other countries have relations with each other and are pursuing agreements with each other.
In addition to the TPP, Asian countries are working on a second regional trade deal, including 16 countries, most notably China. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Back at home, a bill working its way through Congress would, if passed, change the liability rules for internet platforms. Right now, Facebook, Google, Reddit, even the infamous site called Backpage, aren't legally responsible for things their users post on their sites. But the new bill, called the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, would make those companies take on at least some of that responsibility. That would be a huge shift in how the internet works, and one that most big tech companies have opposed. But recently, they're warming up to the idea. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
Under SESTA, the acronym for the bill, social media platforms and search engines could face more federal, state, and civil liability. Emma Lanzo is with the Center for Democracy and Technology.
Anybody who hosts or transmits user content expands the liability that they could face if it ended up being related to sex trafficking.
At first, the big tech companies were against the new regulations, but the main industry lobbying group is now on board after some changes. Gus Hurwitz, who studies cyber law at the University of Nebraska, says that change is politics more than policy. Think Russian-funded ads and the ongoing sexual harassment debate.
I think this is a bad time generally to be an internet platform pushing back against concerns about the content that's being posted to your site.
And he says smaller companies won't be able to afford the necessary monitoring to comply with new regulations. Many victims' advocates are skeptical as well.
We rely on these platforms to detect problematic activity.
Alexandra Levy is with Notre Dame Law School and studies human trafficking.
I think that this is a solution that appears appealing, but in fact, it's not going to do anything really substantive for victims or for reducing the problem.
She says the legislation could have a chilling effect on content and potentially hamper a resource for law enforcement to track illicit activity. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Delegates from around the world are meeting in Bonn, Germany, talking about implementing the Paris Climate Accord. One big goal is curbing rising temperatures caused by too much carbon in the atmosphere. There will, of course, be a lot of focus on limiting future emissions, but a newer approach recognizes that stopping long-term runaway climate change will also require technology to remove carbon from the atmosphere. The BBC's environment correspondent, Matt McGrath, visited a carbon-sucking site near Zurich. Yes, I did just say that. It's where the Swiss company Climeworks is trying to use machines to get rid of CO2.
Well, I've climbed up here to the top of this large industrial facility, and I'm looking down on this collection of what look like giant washing machines that are supposed to be sucking carbon dioxide out of the air. Now, the owners say it's not just another demonstration of a clever technology. They say it's a viable commercial proposition. The machines here in front of me suck in the air, chemicals extract the CO2, which is then pumped to a greenhouse just across the way. The farmers there are very keen to buy the gas because they say it makes their vegetables grow bigger. The greenhouse buys the CO2 from Climeworks because of convenience. Climeworks are able to sell the gas to the farmers for around $600 per ton, which is very expensive. But the company believe that if they can scale up their technology, they can rapidly reduce this figure to around $100 per ton. Climeworks engineer Anka Timofte says that while making money from selling CO2 products is important, it's not as vital as finding profitable ways to remove the gas and store it permanently.
Yeah, the business aspect is obviously also very important to us, but I think where our heart really lies is in avoiding emissions, for example, using carbon dioxide to produce fuels.
They want to remove 1% of the global emissions of CO2 by 2025. There are many, many other types and forms of technology currently being tested to capture and remove carbon from the atmosphere, from coal-fired power plants, and from gas installations. But many environmental campaigners believe that this is a dangerous and distracting trend. The key to dealing with climate change is philosophical, not technical, they say. According to Lily Fuhr from the Heinrich Böll Foundation, the only companies who will really benefit from carbon-removing technologies are the ones who helped put all that CO2 into the atmosphere in the first place.
They're beginning to come up with these magical techno fixes that would in the end help them to prolong the lifespan of their industry. So I think it's actually what we're seeing is a shift in the broader denialism and prevention strategy of the fossil fuel industry.
Back in Switzerland, the young engineers and scientists at Climeworks say their technology isn't about prolonging the life of the fossil fuel industry. Anka Timofte believes we will have to extract carbon from the atmosphere for decades, if not centuries, to come.
Are you optimistic, though, for the future?
Yes, I think we have to be. We are trying to do something. I think this feeds our optimism, and our optimism feeds also our technical development. So it's a bit of a loop.
Matt McGrath sent us that report. Coming up,
we want the paper. We want to keep the paper in Brinkley. We don't want to lose it.
What a small town paper really means to a community. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was off 39 points, a tenth percent, and at 23,422. The Nasdaq gained less than a point, basically flat, finishing at 6,750. And the S&P 500 fell 2 points, less than a tenth percent, to close at 2,582. For the week, the Dow was down a half percent. The Nasdaq and the S&P 500 are both off 0.2%. Drug makers and medical product manufacturers moved lower on fears of competition from Amazon. Who else? Medtronic slipped 1.8%. Baxter International was off 2%. Johnson & Johnson lost 0.5%. Amazon itself landed down 0.3%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.40%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity. A how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. We're going to be talking a lot about shopping in the next couple of weeks here. On a related note, the Federal Reserve reports that Americans now hold about $1 trillion in credit card debt. That was kind of a buzzkill, I know. Enter Max Levchin, co-founder of PayPal. He has created Affirm, a company that partners with stores to offer personal loans on individual purchases. But of course, other companies also offer personal loans like Prosper and Lending Club. Banks are starting to do it too. So I went to Affirm headquarters to ask Levchin what makes his company different.
Today, you will find Affirm at a retailer. We would be offered at the point of sale as an alternative form of payment. So you could borrow money to finance a mattress or a bicycle or any form of housewares.
And are you also doing a different sort of credit evaluation?
Yes. The only way this could work is if we were very good at offering credit to people who would normally be priced out of it.
So, you know, if the goal is to kind of help consumers manage their financial life better, why do this, or why allow them to take out high interest loans on things that they can't afford?
Our loans are simple interest loans as opposed to compound. The other thing that you said, we underwrite to the ability to repay. A very, very important pillar of the business is answering the question, can this person afford this loan, given everything we know about them right now? If the answer our model gives is no, that is not likely to happen, we will not lend.
But it is still debt.
It is debt. I think debt gets a bad name for a good reason, but the actual concept is not inherently bad. If you look at American corporations, every one of them, with very, very few exceptions, has debt. The reason that's fine and consumers get tripped up so much is because American corporations employ at least a handful and typically many, many lawyers and say, let's make sure you don't get screwed.
Why did you decide to start this?
A couple of different reasons. At PayPal, we were really focused on payments, but we never really touched credit and underwriting and lending, which at the time I had a probably more black and white view of, where I thought, you know, borrowing money is just a bad idea. Like, you should not be in debt. But then as I started to research point of sale lending, I had a recollection of a personal story roughly in college when I was a fresh off the boat immigrant. I got myself one of those wonderful point of sale credit cards. missed a few payments in a row and found myself with credit history so trashed that I couldn't buy a car for 7 years on any terms. Well, I was a pretty excellent risk by the time I was 24. We had PayPal was already public and we'd probably already sold it to eBay. And yet I would still go into a car dealership and they'd say, you can have any car you want so long as you pay cash.
I signed up for a credit card so I could get a free Frisbee in college. Same deal.
I
pretty much recovered from that like 10 years ago.
I got a t-shirt out of it.
Yep.
And I clearly got ripped off on the Frisbee as well as the interest rate.
I mean, we are in this moment. I think a lot of consumers just realize that a massive industry that they cannot opt out of is in no way working to protect their interests. How do you continue to convince people that you're different, you know?
You know, that's probably our greatest challenge. No matter how hard we try, we are lumped into the group of people that just doesn't care that much. And that isn't true for us, and our customers certainly know that.
That sounds okay now that you're a private company. At what point is there going to be more pressure to make all the money?
I don't know. I haven't felt it yet. So I think the reason Silicon Valley so rarely attacks industries like finance or lending specifically, which have this skewed set of incentives where if your customers do poorly, you do better. Because Silicon Valley, at its core, is still mostly deeply idealistic. It's easier to do in some industries. Like you can take humans to Mars, and that's a pretty unequivocally awesome thing. And there's not a whole lot of things you can do to do the wrong thing there. With lending, it's much tougher because there's many ways of making more money and screwing your customers in the process. The way we built this company is by massively over-amplifying the sense of mission. Part of it rubs off on the investor base. Every time we bring on an investor, we tell them, hey, here's how we play this thing. It's not going to change.
What if JP Morgan buys you?
I doubt they would. I am pretty focused on building something that's going to stand independently for a very long time.
Max Levchin is the CEO of the Startup Affirm. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
The small town newspaper is in a lot of trouble. There are fewer people in rural America, fewer businesses buying the ads that are the lifeblood of newspapers, and fewer of the newspapers that have been the connective tissue of rural communities. In the next installment of our Way of Life series, Sarah Weitz-Kotecheck with Arkansas Public Media visited that state's Mississippi Delta to see how local papers are trying to hang on.
In a small town called Brinkley, Sandra Kemmer is volunteering in a local cafe to promote the area's economy by giving out rice products.
Hi, y'all. You can have some cookies when you come back. It's rice month.
Agriculture is the center of life here. But for decades, rural Arkansas towns like Brinkley have been dwindling, and with them, a linchpin of daily life, the town newspaper. Kemmer says with spotty internet in the Delta, she uses the paper like a calendar or a daily planner. So she worried when the Brinkley newspaper's building burned down.
It was just really, just almost devastating. You know, we couldn't believe it. What are we going to do? No paper. What will we do? You know, how will we keep up?
But then a 19-year-old college student named Hayden Taylor bought the paper for $5,000. Brinkley rallied around him, and subscriptions, which cost $35 a year, nearly doubled to $1,700. Editor, publisher, and owner Taylor is now 20. Next year, he hopes to expand the paper online.
I don't know what motivated everyone to say so loudly that we want the paper, we want to keep the paper in Brinkley, we don't want to lose it. And just holding on to tradition, probably something along those lines.
Taylor says with low overhead, he and his staff of 4+ volunteers are making ends meet. He says he takes home about $250 a week, an income he supplements with his savings. He says he lives rent-free in a building his family owns. Tom Larimer is head of the Arkansas Press Association, which helps bring in ads for its member papers. He says for a small town, a newspaper is like a school. It's part of the local identity.
You know, when you lose your school, it's very traumatic for a community because you have generations of people that have gone to that school and now it no longer exists. And that's a part of that community that'll never come back.
In over a decade, the state has lost about 12 of 130 newspapers. 3 closed this year, including the White River Journal. It's located in another Delta town, Desark. 95-year-old Dean Walls stopped publication of the 110-year-old family paper this summer.
Most people said
It's a sad day. That's what we heard from a lot of people. It's a sad day when the journal quit coming.
Dean Walls ran the journal for 72 years. At one point, she and her late husband worked in a building with no air conditioning, using an old-fashioned hot lead press.
Mother still has scars on her arms where the hot lead would bounce out of the pot onto her arms.
That's Walls' 78-year-old son, Charles, a retired architect who helps out with the paper. They printed their last edition this August. Desark's outmigration is typical for the Delta. It's lost businesses, and that means few local ads for the paper.
We just can't do what needs to be done. And I don't want to do a sorry job. We've had a good newspaper with a good reputation.
But while the newspaper closed, she and Charles are now working on a free email version with some news and information. They say they won't fully retire because people in Desark just can't imagine life without local news. In Little Rock, I'm Sarah Weitz-Kotacek for Marketplace.
And this final note before we go, if you are in the car right now with children of a certain age, they're going to perk up when I say this word, Musical.ly. For the rest of you, Musical.ly is a social media app where lots of teenagers upload videos of themselves doing 15-second lip syncs to songs or skits. It's got 100 million users and recently expanded into live streaming and original content deals. And the Chinese media company Beijing ByteDance Technology just bought Musical.ly for a reported $800 million to $1 billion. We should note here that analysts say Musical.ly's user base is starting to decline ever so slightly. And earlier this year, I spoke to Alex Hoffman, president of North America for Musical.ly.
We are a business, and the end of the day, a business needs to make money. But our entire focus right now is on growing Musical.ly, growing our user base. There are different revenue streams that we are experimenting with, but we are really at a stage where we are just getting the car out of the garage.
Presumably, Beijing ByteDance Technology has a plan to get the car on the freeway. For what it's worth, when I asked my 10-year-old son recently if he's still into Musical.ly, he shrugged and said, sorta. And we gotta go. The Dow today was off 39 points, a 10th%. The NASDAQ gained less than a point, basically flat. The S&P 500 down 2 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Evelyn LaRubia is the executive editor. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl will be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.